Hello, and welcome to New Books Public Policy. I'm Tevi Troy, your host, and each week we look at a new book in the public policy realm and talk to the author and get their insights into how their book affects the current public policy debate. This week, we're talking to Naomi Schaefer-Riley, the author of The Faculty Lounges and Other Reasons Why You Won't Get the College Education You Paid For. In the book, Naomi criticizes tenure and argues that it is not helpful to professors or to students, and that in the long run, students are getting a worse education as a result of faculty members having tenure. It is a controversial argument, but it is made with good humor and with verve, and I think you will enjoy the book as well as the interview. Hello, Naomi Riley, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy.
Thank you.
We'd love to start by asking you a little bit about yourself. Can you give us a bio and tell us how you came to write this book?
Well, I used to work at the Wall Street Journal editorial page. I used to cover education, culture, philanthropy for them, and a little bit of religion as well. And I have been writing about higher education, actually, for about a dozen years now. I'm the daughter of two PhDs and the sister of one as well. And so I've kind of had an insider's view of higher education for a long time. My parents started picking my college when I was about two, I think. And, but, you know, over the course of the years, it's kind of been interesting to me to see kind of how much I've been privy to as far as understanding how higher education works, but how little I think American consumers, that is to say parents and students, understand about it. And so I became particularly interested in, you know, sort of the faculty system, the academic workforce, and kind of how people got promoted and what kinds of things were rewarded. And that led me to write The Faculty Lounges and Other Reasons Why You Won't Get the College Education You Paid For.
You know, in many ways, this is a very distressing book. We're not happy with the tenure system as you describe it. And as you said, you're not getting the college education you pay for. But at the same time, it's also a funny book. The first line of the book is a line I had not heard before, but it did make me laugh, which is, first get tenure, then hoist the Jolly Roger. At other times, you have cartoons, although I thought you were going to have a cartoon before each chapter. You just have it in front of many chapters, but some of them are pretty funny, including the one where somebody's, tossing away their pants, because we don't need pants anymore. We now have tenure.
Right, exactly.
Talk a little bit about the way you're trying to make the point through humor and how you found the cartoons you're using.
It's a really hard topic. It's a huge blob of bureaucracy and a lot of kind of insiders lingo. And it's a lot of the arguments that have been had about higher education are arguments among insiders. And a lot of the kind of outsiders don't really think that they have much of a stake in it. They kind of think, well, I'm just going to pick where my kid goes to college based on what name sounds right to me. And hopefully they'll be happy there and then they'll get their ticket to the middle class. But, you know, I think you have to kind of find a way to talk to the general audience, which is to say parents, students, and taxpayers, about the system. And I hope that a little bit of humor might help this kind of complex subject go down a little bit easier. I try not to write kind of inside baseball. I think that there are a lot of important issues here. And I think that contrary to what most college professors will tell you, the average educated layperson can actually understand a lot of them. You don't have to have a PhD to understand what's going on.
Yeah, you said that, but at the same time, you said both of your parents have PhDs, or at least your dad did.
No, they both do. My mother, my father, and my only sibling, my sister, all have PhDs. So it's just me who doesn't.
Do you feel very left out when they talk about footnotes or dissertations or
readings? I feel like I was sort of steeped in that world for a long time. It was not only my parents, obviously, most of their friends, you know, were friends from graduate school or friends, who taught with them now. And so I've been exposed to that world for a long time. And I almost went to graduate school myself, to be perfectly frank about it. So I don't feel left out in some sense, but I joke with them that, you know, now I'm the only one left in my immediate family who knows how to screw in a light bulb, because all practical sense immediately gets removed once you have a PhD. But I don't, you know, I think that there is a sense in which you know, my own parents, I think kind of don't necessarily value a lot of the things that many people who value PhDs get, which is to say, I think they still value clear writing. I think they are very suspicious of kind of the lingos and the jargon, even of their own disciplines. My mother actually writes, she runs a small think tank, and she writes more for a general audience, you know, than a typical academic would. She writes reports telling the city of Worcester, which is where my parents live, what it's doing wrong. And so she's writing sort of more public policy papers, which I think have to be understood more generally. So I think, you know, in that sense, I kind of have one foot in each world.
You know, one thing I would take slight issue with is you say that when you get a PhD, all sense immediately leaves, or all practical sense immediately leaves. Because I myself have a PhD, and I know it's not immediate. It takes 6 to 8 years if you're lucky.
Oh, 6 to 8 years if you're lucky, yes, definitely. One of the things that I found in this book, probably one of the most shocking statistics, if not the most shocking one, was the median time to get an English PhD is 11 years. And I got tired reading that sentence. I mean, I can't even, you know, it's hard to fathom just how much of people's lives gets sucked up these days. And I think a lot of outsiders don't realize just how much that has lengthened. I mean, you really used to be able to get a PhD in, you know, 6 or 7 years, and maybe even 5 if you were fast about it. And there was kind of an interesting article by Louis Menand, which I talk about in the book, where he sort of tried to figure out why it's taking so long to get PhDs, particularly for humanities scholars. And he said, well, you know, with a hard science, you assume, well, there's so many years of lab work and you're trying to discover something new and there's so much trial and error. But then he sort of thought about it for a while and he realized that for the humanities, you know, the incentive now is all for PhDs to try to find something new to say about something. And the niche, you know, to do that is just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so what you have is these humanities graduate students who are banging their heads against a wall. You know, they think they finally come up with a novel take on, you know, a certain act of a play of Shakespeare. And it turns out that someone somewhere, you know, at the University of Kansas actually wrote that last year. And then they have to start from scratch. And it's infuriating. And I can't think, actually, that it's a very good use of the minds of these people, and that this is the way we want our most talented people to be spending their time.
Yeah, I think there are some other reasons there as well, including the fact that when they do graduate, there are no jobs, and so they want to stay in the academic womb as long as possible.
Sure. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the lack of jobs is not a new thing, and I'm always surprised when I talk to people, to young graduate students who are complaining about the job situation. I mean, I can remember, you know, when I was 7 years old, my parents would have, you know, people coming through, you know, just to visit, or, you know, and this discussion would be all about how so-and-so can't get a job, so-and-so has to work in a different city from his wife, you know, so-and-so didn't publish enough, and so they won't be getting tenure, and they have to start all over again. I mean, it's a very sad story, but on the other hand, I also feel like you wouldn't have to read the Chronicle of Higher Education for more than a week before you realize that that was the situation. I mean, it hasn't changed. And I do wonder, you know, why I still, after studying the subject, still can't figure out why people continue to go to graduate school, particularly in subjects where, you know, the PhD is not giving you another option. I mean, maybe if you get a PhD in political science, okay, you can go work at a think tank. You get a PhD in, you know, immunology, you can go work for a drug company or something like that. There are other options besides academia. But for PhDs in humanities and even a lot of the social sciences, I think your options are extraordinarily limited.
Yeah, whenever people ask me advice about going to graduate school, I always say it's fine to go get a PhD. It's a interesting and useful degree. Well, maybe not that useful, a helpful degree in helping people think to some extent. But I always tell them, assume that you're not going to get a teaching job and figure out what you would do without that teaching job.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think there are a lot of people who are really unprepared. And, you know, this leads to the question about, you know, who is doing the teaching? And that, you know, obviously many colleges have just decided that teaching undergraduates, broad introductory classes, for instance, is not something you need a PhD for at all. I mean, and I tend to agree with them. I mean, do you need to have completed your dissertation in some obscure research topic before you teach undergraduates Poli-Sci 101? And the answer is probably no. And in some ways, you know, I feel like the academics have kind of dug themselves into this hole where the training to become an academic has very little to do with what you do when you become an academic. I was talking to someone recently who is the editor of a kind of thinky magazine, and he left academia recently after about 20 years. And he said to me, well, you know, Naomi, I was teaching the same classes year after year, and I would try to change the syllabi a little, but, you know, it's hard doing that, you know, year after year. And I said, well, what did you expect when you were in graduate school? Did you not expect that this is how you were going to be spending your time? And he said, nobody really talked about it. You know, the whole teaching thing seemed so secondary.
That is the problem. It's too often secondary. Well, as you said, you had two parents. One has tenure. One does not have tenure. And I assume that shaped your view to some extent. At the same time, in the book, you say that your view used to be, well, faculty members like tenure, so who am I to argue? Have your views on this subject evolved to the point where you're writing a book that's explicitly anti-tenure?
I mean, you know, the tenure was always kind of like the joke. I mean, so it's the punchline of a lot of academic jokes. And I sort of just figured, well, you know, it was something that I was so used to growing up. I mean, I remember, one of my first jobs I had, like I was complaining to my dad one day about how I didn't like something my boss was doing. And he said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, nothing, because you know what? I want this job still. I mean, it was kind of an interesting, I think, both for my dad and me, kind of this moment where it was like, oh, you really have entered a different world here. So I think, you know, there's a sense in which I just thought I was just unquestioning about it. I mean, I questioned a lot of academic nonsense, but tenure on its face didn't seem to me to be, you know, something that was so bad. I mean, I couldn't trace a lot of the problems of academia to that in particular. So, you know, what led me to really start to wonder about tenure was the research question. I mean, you know, I certainly had been aware for a long time that there was a teaching problem in our universities, that it wasn't being done well, and that it was not considered a priority. And when I started looking into that, I realized just how much that problem was really wrapped up in tenure. I mean, you know, to begin with, of course, you know, tenure is given on the basis of research, and it was designed that way. I mean, tenure was really designed as a system to allow people to engage in this kind of far-reaching academic inquiry. It wasn't really about classroom life at the beginning. Classroom life was kind of, it was not something that people felt you had to necessarily go out on a huge limb for. But finding new knowledge and developing new theories, that was something that you needed the protections of tenure for. So then what happened was, you know, over the years, it's basically been this, you know, race to the bottom, I would say, in terms of the research. I mean, I talked to one professor at Michigan State who said, you know, when I came here 30 years ago, people used to bring in the research that they wanted us to consider for tenure in a loose leaf folder. And now they bring it in two Xerox boxes. And I mean, it should just give you an idea of the quantity, and the quality certainly has not, in my opinion, increased. And more importantly, the readership of all of this research has actually diminished over the years. So, you know, how do you weigh the fact that you're producing a lot more of this, fewer people are actually consuming it, and there's no change in the quality, but yet we're rewarding it with this job for life? So I think that sort of was, I think, one of the biggest things that I noticed about tenure that bothered me. The second thing was that I have long been concerned that faculty are kind of driving undergraduate education into the ground. I mean, I think that they are off in their own little world, as I said, doing their research, but they're also in control of a whole lot of parts of education that are really problematic. I mean, you know, they're in charge of, I think faculty have largely been responsible for the end of the core curriculum. So, you know, now when a 17-year-old walks onto campus, we just assume that they know what they should be studying. We hand them some giant, thick administrative course guide and say, here, choose your own adventure. And, you know, in my humble opinion, you know, 17-year-olds don't really know what they don't know. And you can't just pretend that they're going to give themselves a good college education just by flipping to a random page. So I think there's that thing that the faculty are responsible for. And tenure has really given them the power over the curriculum, but it's also given them power over weird things, like why do faculty get to decide when they teach their courses? I mean, I've had students complain to me that they cannot graduate on time because all their faculty are having classes at the same time and they can't get the classes they need that are required to graduate. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, the story about you and your dad and your job woes, I guess, reminds me of the cartoon you have on page 15, which is of a bespectacled, pipe-smoking professor who goes to a lawyer, and the lawyer says, "Your wife hasn't broken the law, professor. She can leave you even if you do have tenure." So there's this sense of entitlement that professors have. And then you talk a little bit about the publications, and I think you have a very pithy way of describing how they might be forced to publish more, but it's not necessarily more interesting or more useful or more informative. You call it more publication, less relevance.
So there's
a number of factors that are going together. You've got this sense of entitlement, this marginalization or this increased specialization. And then one other thing you talk about is the lack of transparency, and you call transparency a threat to academics. Can you talk a little bit about how that threat plays out and how we can combat it?
Well, there are a couple of different ways. There was an interesting piece after I published the book by a professor named Daniel Dresner, who's now at Tufts. But prior to that,
people who've listened to the podcast know that we have had him on his zombie book.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know if he talked about his tenure experience, but he wrote about it for the Chronicle recently. And actually, his wife wrote about his tenure experience, too. So he was at the University of Chicago for 6 or 7 years. Everything was going great. As you know, he's a well-respected scholar. And I gather from the fact that he's interested in a broader audience that maybe he's a good teacher, too. I don't know for sure. And I think he doesn't know either. So, then a bunch of his colleagues basically go into a room one day and decide he doesn't get tenure. And tenure is an up or out system, which means if you don't get tenure, you're done. You need to leave. So, I mean, I think that is sort of an oddity of the system to begin with. But Dresner sort of talked in this piece, which I found really kind of interesting from an academic insider, about this weird feeling that these people that you've been working with on a daily basis, all of a sudden one day can decide, and without giving you any reason in particular, that you're done. And, they don't have to give you any warning about it ahead of time. And, it could be based on anything. I mean, some schools consider, for instance, collegiality a reason to give or deny someone tenure. So basically, it's sort of like fourth grade all over again. How friendly are you with your colleagues? And then they basically have a little popularity contest. Often, of course, it's about ideology. Are your views, whether, by the way, they're on politics or string theory or something else, are they in line with the rest of the departments? And this is, of course, how you get this kind of tremendous ideological uniformity on campus, which is this system of departmental majoritarianism, as they call it. You get to basically faculty just keep voting in clones of themselves. So, I mean, the transparency issue to me is something that academics really like to talk about. They always are advocating for more transparency in other professions. We have departments of medical ethics now and legal ethics and all of these things. Many people would say, well, the first thing you need is transparency. But we don't have any academic ethics, and there is very little, in my opinion, transparency in the process.
You mentioned this thing about the I guess, ideological clones. And it seems to me that the original point of tenure was to give full free speech rights to professors so they could say whatever they wanted, whatever they thought, and so you could have diversity of views, and it's turned out to be the opposite. And you even tell this really frightening story, and I thought I'd heard it all. I've read many of the books on political correctness, but this Berkeley class guide that has a phrase in there that says conservative thinkers are encouraged to seek other sections. I mean, could you imagine a conservative professor teaching a class saying liberal thinkers encouraged to seek other sections, or a Muslim studies group saying Jewish students encouraged to seek other sections, or any other group based on their ideology, their race, their perspective? It's mind-boggling.
No, it to me is. I mean, the statistic that I start that chapter with is looking at the McCain, the giving to the McCain and the Obama campaigns. And I'm sure everybody realizes that there is a serious discrepancy on campus, but faculty members gave to the Obama campaign by a factor of 8-1 over McCain's campaign. It's a lopsidedness that is not really represented elsewhere. And you have all of these academics scrambling now to come up with explanations for why. But the most common one you hear from academics is, well, it's because conservatives are stupid and you know, only smart people go into academia. I mean, it is truly kind of amazing the level of insularity, you know, that this encourages. So, I mean, part of it, the question of tenure for me was, you know, looking at it as a test, you know, okay, tenure was put in place to encourage, you know, academic freedom and the freedom of people to dissent, you know, from what is the sort of general consensus. And there are so few campuses where that happens now and so few professors where they do that. I mean, one of the, you know, we talked a little bit about the length of time that is required to get a PhD, but then after that, so, you know, say you're finally, assuming you started graduate school right after college, so maybe you're 30 when you get your PhD, then you spend another, you know, 6 or 7 years, although the University of Michigan just increased its tenure clock to 10 years, trying to get tenure. So then say you're closer to 40, and then all of a sudden you're going to hoist the Jolly Roger. You know, I mean, people get kind of used to a particular way of behaving around their colleagues. And what the way of behaving in academia is, you know, keep your head down and your mouth shut unless you happen to agree with, you know, the majority of people in your department and on campus. I think there's really no way of getting around that fact. So you kind of train people to not dissent. And then, you know, and I don't think then tenure really does much, you know, in terms of encouraging people to suddenly speak up.
Yeah, you mentioned this stat about 8-1 faculty donations in favor of Obama back in 2000. But you mentioned a more surprising statistic to me, that a majority of professor donations went to Bush in 2000. Is that right?
I was surprised. I read that in the Chronicle, but I think it does sort of, you know, leaving aside academia for a little bit, I think it suggests to you the way in which the kind of elite views have changed, how much Bush hatred really had an effect on a certain class in America. One of the other interesting statistics that I came across was that they're actually the hard sciences used to be much more balanced in terms of their political views. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was much closer to 50-50 than, say, the social sciences or the humanities. And, you know, people would, you know, offer all sorts of explanations for that. You know, the typical explanation that you get on the left is, well, it's the Republican war on science, and they've decided they don't like evolution, and all these scientists have caught on to that fact, and that's why they're giving the Democrats. But I think, you know, the other explanation, which is also perhaps equally true, is that a lot of science has become politicized. I mean, you have entire departments like climate science that have become completely, that are basically put on campus just because they have a political purpose. So to me, the idea is that, you know, you have the hard science professors are basically themselves becoming politicized, and maybe that accounts for a lot of the distinction now.
This raises an interesting question, which is you talk about the statistic that federal grants to higher education are about $32 billion. You say that there's a subsidy, an effective subsidy of about $50,000 per academic article, which is also mind-boggling to me. But you also have the situation where the professoriate is so overwhelmingly Democrat. In this era of budget cuts, do you think that Republicans might say, maybe universities are a place we can look at for cutting budgets, or are Republicans just as in the tank for academia as the Democrats are?
Well, they're definitely not. I mean, the question is, at the federal level, I think it's unlikely, because at the federal level, obviously, the biggest form of subsidies is Pell Grants. And I think very few Republicans, unless you're Ron Paul, really want to be against financial aid. I mean, college is thought of as the great a kind of social equalizer, and we want to obviously give opportunities to people on the bottom of the economic ladder. So nobody really wants to come out against the federal financial aid program. Although, of course, if you talk to people like Richard Vedder at the Center for College Affordability and Productivity, they will show you the charts that suggest our third-party payer system, that basically we are not giving colleges any incentive to rein in costs. In fact, we're saying, you want to raise your prices? Great, we'll give you more money to help you do that. So the incentives certainly are all wrong there. But as far as whether anyone is willing to look at colleges and suggest budget cuts, I mean, certainly I think you're having a very interesting fight going on in Texas right now over costs at state universities. And publication has really come up as a subject where some serious cuts are being thought about. People are questioning the teaching loads of faculty. And again, the Richard Vedder Center, I think, came out with a statistic that showed that 20% of the faculty were doing something like 80% of the work. So I think that is at the state level, the budget cuts are definitely, I think, being thought about more. The other thing I think very few people realize, and even state legislators don't realize, at the state university level, at the research university level, about half of professor salaries go toward research, which is to say they're teaching a half a course load because it is assumed that they are spending 50% of their time publishing. So if you ask a state legislator, they will say, oh, we don't subsidize research. They just get grants for that. But in fact, through faculty salaries and the way those salaries are structured, we are subsidizing research to an incredible extent.
I'm glad you mentioned Vedder, because he really is a different kind of thinker on these issues. When I was in the Bush White House, the Department of Education was putting together a commission on higher ed, and I insisted that they put Vedder on to the dismay of some of the kind of faculty voices out there. But you also mentioned that he has a special ranking, a Vedder Forbes ranking of what schools are better, and that doesn't necessarily go by the U.S. News approach. Can you talk about the Vedder Forbes ranking, how it works, and if it's available, where we can find it?
Sure. You can go on the Forbes website, and it's done with Forbes and the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. It's not actually the Vedder Forbes ranking, but he's certainly a lot of the brains behind the operation. So what Vedder decided to do, which I thought was fairly interesting, was look at bang for your buck. So he looked at, for instance, how much students were going into debt to go to a particular school. He looked at starting salaries coming out of a particular school. And he looked at, how many students were getting different kinds of awards, a Marshall Scholarship, a Rhodes Scholarship, things like that. One of the, I think, most important criticisms of the U.S. News rankings is that they base a significant portion of their formula on the reputation of the school. And the reputation of the school is basically determined by other faculty and administrators, and the other faculty and administrators determine that based on a record of publication. That is how you hear about the reputation of another school, is through publication. So I just caution people. I mean, I think it is great that, U.S. News has this ranking. I think it's made a lot more information readily available to parents and students. But I'm also happy that other people are coming out with rankings that look at the data differently. Because I think, we need all the kind of raw material out there. But just the things that may be important to U.S. News may not be important to you as a parent or a student. So I encourage you to sort of go beyond, should I go to school number 53 or number 75? Well, of course, number 53, and really think about how they're being ranked. Unfortunately, there's not a good system right now in place for ranking what I think is the most important thing, which is teaching. The American Council for Trustees and Alumni has a ranking system that it's called What Will They Learn, where they give colleges grades based on requirements in core subjects. which I think is useful. And I think, you know, the schools generally that are requiring people to take, you know, economics 101 or a survey of British literature, you know, that goes over a significant period of time, you know, I think students are generally going to be better served by those schools. On the other hand, again, it can't measure the quality of teaching. And I would really, you know, for those parents and students who are in a position to go visit colleges, I try to offer a little bit of advice in the book, like don't go visit over the middle of the summer when no one is there and classes are not in session. You can admire the scenery, but you could do that just as well from your computer at home. I encourage people to go sit in on classes and not just, you know, if you go to some schools, they'll say, oh, well, come to our advanced level, you know, constitutional law seminar. Well, you may not be in that seminar for 4 years. So, you know, go sit in on an intro class. If there are 600 people around you and the professor is kind of dull and just presenting PowerPoint slides, you need to ask yourself, like, will I learn in this class? And I think parents need to be asking their kids those questions as well.
Do you find that there's a lot of variation in teaching ability or teaching quality at different schools? I mean, have you tried this test yourself, or have people who you suggested it to tried the test?
I have over the last dozen years, I have sat in on countless college classes, and the variety is to me amazing. I mean, you will have teachers who literally are just reading off of PowerPoint slides. You wouldn't have to show up. I mean, if they gave you the PowerPoint slides, there would be no reason for you to show up in class. And it's utterly dull, mind numbing. I mean, I can't describe it. And I sort of understand something about these subjects. If I were an 18-year-old sitting in on this class for the first time, I would think to myself, you know, this is not even a discipline I'm interested in, if this is representative. And that's the problem. I mean, the people that we're putting in front of intro classes are typically the least experienced people who have the most other things that they're supposed to be doing. I mean, there are typically these adjunct professors, you know, many of whom don't make very much money, don't have office hours, you know, and their goal is just to publish so that they can move up to the next level. Instead of forcing senior professors, you know, somebody who has, you know, who has been tried and tested and kind of understands what students need to know, and also, you know, finding somebody who's actually excited about the discipline to put in front of that intro class to make it more exciting, to make students interested in it. I mean, the number of students majoring in the humanities has plummeted in recent years. And I think part of that is just like the content, and part of that is who is standing in front of them. I mean, for better or worse, students see the obvious benefit to studying accounting. But if you want them to understand why they should study English, you have to make the case. And I think so few of our professors seem to me, and just in what I've seen, capable of making that as strongly as they should be.
Yeah, two other reasons I would put out there for why humanities majors have been declining is one, the lack of practical application to many of these degrees, but also what we were talking about a little bit earlier with the bias, the political bias. And you talk a little bit about this as it relates to tenure. You say that some people argue that conservatives like tenure because it protects them. And I want to see what you think of that. And then you also have the very interesting retort from Checker Finn, who says that, yes, perhaps it does, but it also protects the right of 400,000 liberals to say whatever the heck they want.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I certainly expected to come up against. And certainly I've had this argument with my own father. I mean, I feel like to the extent that there is a little bit of dissent on campus here and there, certainly tenure has protected a few good conservative professors, and I'm happy that it has. But like I said before, I just and they will, you know, they'll make the case in a variety of ways. I mean, they'll say, look, you know, if I want to criticize the administration or my, you know, liberal colleagues or whatever, you know, tenure has protected me and it's the only reason I still have a job. They've also gone further. I mean, I think, you know, you've had, I interviewed some professors who, you know, conservative professors who said, you know, it does encourage good research. And there is something useful out there about requiring professors to write academic treatises. That is, that they can't just, you know, sort of BS the way you can in front of a classroom if you're a good entertainer. But ultimately, I don't think those arguments stack up. I mean, I think there's so little emphasis on teaching that it's very hard to make the case that that their time is better spent doing research. But as far as the argument of conservative professors, I mean, I've been accused of sort of throwing the few conservatives under a bus with this argument, and I guess I have to plead guilty. I mean, but I think the system is so broken, that it really needs to be reorganized, and the academic labor market, which of course the professors don't like it to like when I call it that, but the academic labor market really needs to change significantly. And I think it's not just for the benefit of students. I mean, although I think that they should be our primary concern. I mean, professors are so unhappy, and one of the reasons that professors are so unhappy is because when they do get tenure, then they're stuck for life, probably. In many cases, in a place they don't want to be. I mean, there's no movement in the job market. It's not just that there are no jobs. It's that once you get one, don't ever expect to move or find another one. Your spouse may be unhappy. This may not be the best place for your family, but there will never be another job opening for you.
My brother got his PhD from Harvard in history, and he said that he was the only one of his cohort to have both tenure and a spouse. Because some people gave up and got married, and some people went to Nowheresville and never got married.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, the double academic couples is just, these tragedies. I mean, if you do want to, if you want to get tenure, you basically need to have someone who is independently wealthy, or someone who can just pick up and move their business or their profession to wherever, East Nowheresville that you would like to move.
Now, the last thing I want to get into before I ask our signature final question here on New Books in Public Policy is about this notion of the education bubble. You mentioned the labor market for professors. I know they don't like the term, but there's a market for education or for college education in general. And you talk about high tuition, bias in classes, questionable economic returns, the irrelevance of many of the classes. Do you think there is a bubble in higher education? What will happen if and when it crashes, and how can we hedge against the bubble?
I think there is something of a bubble, but the problem is that there is nothing competing with higher education right now in my mind. So I'm not one of those people who will say, don't go to college, it's not worth it, and everyone's going to realize that in 10 years that the whole enterprise was worthless. Because the credential that you get, it's your ticket to the middle class life in America. It's your ticket to a profession. And I don't think that it has, to tell you the truth, a lot to do with what you learn in college, unfortunately. I mean, going back to Richard Vedder, he did this interesting study where he found out that bartenders who had college degrees earned more than bartenders who didn't have college degrees. So, it is clearly not something as much as you drink in college. What you learn in college that makes for that salary bump, it is something about your resume, something that signifies, oh, I work hard, I show up on time, I come from a middle-class milieu, I took the SATs, these kinds of things that have zero to do with what you learned in the classroom. So I do think that there is an argument for offering somehow more alternatives to at least the bachelor's degree. I mean, whether that's more for-profit higher education, whether those are more apprenticeships, whether companies can start offering more in the way of on-the-job training or vocational education. I think all of those things may start to slowly deflate but not suddenly pop the higher education bubble. So, hedging against that, to me, as a society, it means we start to offer people other avenues, tickets to getting the middle-class American dream. It doesn't mean that we suddenly all decide to skip college altogether.
Yeah, you touched on this a little bit, but I do want to ask our final signature question here on New Books in Public Policy, and thank you for being so generous with your time. But usually we close off with the question of, if you were czar for a day, what public policy proposals would you initiate as a result of what you've seen in writing this book?
I mean, we've talked about it. I guess my big policy proposal would be eliminating tenure. And, as far as the czar for a day question, I mean, it depends on, you know, czar of what. I mean, if I were in charge of, you know, sort of public universities, I guess I could do this a little bit. I don't think private colleges are going to have as much incentive to change so quickly. But certainly, I think in particular states, you're going to see more pressure to end this kind of job for life sinecure. I think, you know, we didn't get into this, but one of the things that I would really like to see, we're sort of reaching this moment in higher education where, you know, tenure is actually starting to make up there are fewer and fewer as a percentage tenured faculty members. And a lot of people say to me, well, why would you eliminate tenure now? I mean, it seems to be on its way out. I don't think it's on its way out. But what you've gotten is kind of this two-tiered system where the people at the top get to make the rules, they get to do the obscure research, they hide in their office, they don't have much contact with students, and the people at the bottom who have very little experience, very little incentive to engage with students, I mean, they could find out a week before the semester begins whether they have a job at all, those are the people that we have assigned teaching to. And to me, now is the time to kind of think seriously about how we'd like to see the system look 20 years from now. And so I think you eliminate tenure, you replace it with multi-year renewable contracts, and, you know, you start treating academia like the rest of the economy. I always say to people, you know, if the rest of us were as obsessed with job security as academics were, the entire economy would come to a grinding halt.
Well, let's hope the entire economy does not come to a grinding halt, even though it hasn't been doing much better in the last few years. The book is The Faculty Lounges and Other Reasons Why You Won't Get the College Education You Paid For. The author is Naomi Schaefer Riley, and I want to thank you for joining us today on New Books Public Policy.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to an interview with Naomi Schaefer Riley, the author of The Faculty Lounges and Other Reasons Why You Won't Get the College Education You Paid For. This is an interesting critique of tenure. I think it's funny and engaging, even if controversial. You may not agree, but I think you will find it to be an enjoyable read. So, Tevi Troy for New Books in Public Policy, urging you to read this book and, in general, keep reading.